Session number 12251, Mr. S. Wood, Reel 2.
Mr. S.D. Wood, Reel 2. What were the living conditions like in the searchlight unit, Mr. Wood?
Well, initially, on arrival at the site, we pitched a bell tent. And that was our actual sleeping accommodation. Fortunately, on the site where we were, a farmhouse had a tiny cottage in the corner of the field, which allowed our cook to set up a cooking facility on a little range there, and a little room where we could go and sit and eat out of the cold. But otherwise, there were no other facilities available to us for cooking or shelter. And the latrine facilities was purely a bar across a trench with a Hessian protection round. This was for night and day use.
Did you cook your own food?
No, we had a cook, a lad called Harry Weirs. He did all the cooking in sort of those facilities for us.
The food situation, was it good food?
Oh yes, we got pretty good rations in those days. Obviously the war was not so far advanced that there wasn't reasonable supplies available.
I didn't ask you, were you part of a system whereby you fed into that system to...
Not in the early stages, no. It was virtually, you had a telephone line which you could connect back to headquarters, but no, you were an independent unit. There was no connection, really, with night fighter squadrons at that stage or any other anti-aircraft activities other than they may be on patrol when a raid took place. And if you happened to locate with your listening device and direct your searchlight onto a plane and there was a plane in the area, all right, some action could be taken. But there was no real organisation in the very early days, no, of that nature.
So a great deal of it was visual.
Yes. And listening with these, as I explained, these four conical things on a tripod, only had headphones, and you listened and moved to locate any approaching aircraft, and then direct the laddie controlling the searchlight, which he had a wheel control, which said left, right, up, down, so they could obviously get somewhere near the... approaching plane.
Was it easy to hold moving aircraft?
No, not in the early stages, because we hadn't much practice on moving targets. Even prior to the war breaking out, there were no real facilities for practicing locating and lighting up aircraft movements.
How confident were you then, as a unit yourself, of being able to defend your area against aircraft?
Well, to the extent that we only had a Lewis machine gun on the post, and there actually was an occasion some weeks in the early days after where an aircraft was approaching. If I recollect, it seemed to be coming from the southwest direction, which suggests it might have been in the Midlands. And we were called out, because there's there was always a guard on duty, and he would call out the whole setup if aircraft were heard. And on this occasion, we were called out, started the diesel, got everything going, listened, and we swung round to the direction, and we thought we were in that line, and we actually, then you put the lever, the searchlight came on, and this plane actually dived down towards the site and dropped a bomb, which we're told later was probably about a 100-pound bomb, in the very next field to us, and then went out over Beachy Head and across the... and that was our first actual contact with any enemy activity at all.
Did you have much contact thereafter?
Very little in that area.
Well, these would be the days of the Thorny War and the build-up.
Yes, and there were just reconnaissance planes, obviously, to see what possible anti-aircraft defences were available, you know, to us to keep them. And as I say, the areas most vulnerable in those days were not the coastal region where we were, which is Scarborough, Bridlington, around there. It was either the Tyneside or the North East area or the Midlands. Or, you know, there was no real facilities which needed attack by air where we were.
What are your memories of officers in this unit?
Pretty good, by and large, because we were all from the same town or district. We knew them. Therefore, it was very reasonable and no real snags at all, because we were, in our case, we had a captain in there who actually was our assistant works manager at the works where at least five of us came from. So everybody knew everybody else. So the conditions and the feeling was pretty good.
What was his name?
Captain Harry Brown, actually. He later went into... Well, he left the battalion at some later stage, and he ultimately became a colonel and was in the occupation of the forces after the war.
And what of NCOs? What are your memories of those?
Well, everybody was pretty good. As I say, being a local battalion, and lads who you trained with and you knew, by and large, there was obviously the odd one out. And a little later in that year, when we had other people coming in, it still didn't destroy this sort of feeling that everybody knew everybody. So the tolerance level was pretty good, because we knew most people.
Was there much horse playing?
Yes, there obviously was in the early stages, because we didn't realise really what we were in for. I mean, as I explained earlier on, you know, we went to camp. We didn't think at that stage we were never going to get back from that. And it just developed gradually, and it was fairly stable and quiet. And the local people were very good to us. I remember quite clearly that if you were on sentry duty, parading round the field while everybody was sleeping, and you took every on a two-hour duty at night, that if you happened to be passing down the far fence of this site, and they were backing the cars out and or going to work, they'd invite you in, you'd have a cup of tea and a bacon sandwich and a chat with them, and people were leaving supplies at the gate. They'd pull up and leave a parcel of goodies or extra food, and they appreciated everything we were doing. They were very, very helpful and very considerate.
So discipline wasn't too tight?
No, not at that stage. As I say, it was only a very small unit. You're talking about 12 on the side. So it was fairly even.
You mentioned how good the people were. What about leisure activities? Did you get away from your site on occasions?
Not really. Not at that stage. The only weekly sort of excursion was one to the baths at Scarborough, where we all went into the public baths and had our baths and had a couple of hours in Scarborough, having a beer and having a wander around, then getting back to site. And that was your once-a-week break from the routine of being on site.
And what about leave? Did you get any leave?
I can't remember, really, but at that stage, no. I can't recollect in the early stages where we got any early leave. That came later. Initially, no, for the first 3 months, but we did. We were allowed visitors, strangely enough. We had people coming down from Darlington and the area, you see, and would arrange to anybody who had anybody coming, well, they allowed them to go off-site and into Bridlington and or whatever to see their families.
How did you keep yourselves occupied on the site? Obviously, there must have been quite boring moments.
Well, there was the daily routine of checking equipment and cutting out practices, but we played football and, you know, games, but really, if you'd been up quite a part of the night, most of us were on a two-hour duty, it was midday, really, before the site came out as a full unit, and then you all did your service duties and cleaned your rifles and your machine guns and checked the searchlight, checked the diesel. So it became fairly routine, but there wasn't a lot happening, really, at that stage of the war.
Did you get any kind of district inspections, people coming in to inspect you?
No, just within the battalion. Just, you know, the headquarters people. They had the headquarters in Filey, in a hotel there, and there was always headquarters people coming around to check that rations were okay and everybody was, equipment was being maintained, and with a routine inspection.
How long were you there, and when did you get your next move?
Clear. We were moved around in different sites to give sort of change of habitat and everything else. And I was actually moved to a site near Driffield, a little village called Langtoff on the hilltop. And by this time, they'd start putting sort of a Nissen hut type building up for us to sleep in, but the other facilities were still very limited.
About what time was this, Mr. Wood?
This was probably about 3 months or so after the outbreak of war. And by November, I was sent on a course to the, at Huddersfield, to the Duke of Wellington Barracks there. And I also was sent to the British Railways Gymnasium at York on a PTI course, that's a physical training instructor. So when I came back from that, actually, I was taken off site and transferred to the headquarters at Filey, where I was in charge of physical training for intake and all the personnel on that particular site at Filey.
Were these both physical training courses?
No, the other was just updating you on any information which had been discovered once we're in the field. So we're getting lectures on things they'd think, and we're getting recommendations how to carry out our drills.
Was the equipment changing at all?
Not at that stage, no.
The physical training course, what exactly did that entail?
Well, that was just a complete boxing. All the normal things would in the physical training course, so that you could go back and take physical training classes for the headquarters staff and the new intake which were coming in at the time.
So from this time, coming off that course, you were basically training people physically?
Yes, I was transferred to the battalion headquarters at Fire in the Crescent Hotel. This would be in early in 1940.
So what were your duties then? What exactly were you doing?
Well, mostly the physical training of the intake, because we had the other people coming in with people moving about, and just normal guard duties and physical training.
Can you describe some of the drills and exercises of a PE course? Well,
it was just, it's difficult really to describe all the different things, but it was purely physical training, stretching, swinging, club swinging, trotting, you know, purely just basic things just to ensure that everybody was maintaining a reasonable fitness standard.
Did this go on through the whole of the day? Or
no, you took so many, you know, different units. You didn't take up the whole of the people at headquarters. You took so many at a time in the morning and the afternoon.
Was there any great difficulty? How were you finding the men that were coming to you? Were they fit?
Some were, and obviously some weren't. This was probably the reason they installed this setup, to make sure that everybody was at least a reasonable standard of fitness to carry out the duties.
How long did you do these duties?
Well, this carried on until approximately 14 months after September, since the outbreak of war. And at battalion headquarters, they'd been asked to nominate any potential officer cadets that they might have to go for training. And I went in front of a selection board, and they wanted to know my background, school, where I worked, what I'd achieved it in sort of exam results, whatever, which was basically a junior Oxford, a school certificate, matriculation. And subsequent to that, within a matter of quite a short space of time, probably several weeks, I can't remember exactly, I then got a posting to Shrivenham in Wiltshire, which was then the officer training unit for new intake.
Do you recall what date that was?
Well, as I say, it was approximately 14 months after the outbreak of war.
How were you received there?
Well, pretty well, because basically we were all a new intake, and the instructors were obviously regulars, and it was the college which had been established, a new place. And no, we were treated well, but basically no, because you were amongst people like yourself who had been nominated for a commission, and we got on quite well, actually.
Was this an institution, was a general one? It wasn't just training for artillery officers?
This, obviously, unit, as far as I can recollect, and it's a right bit of a grey area, but as we'd come from searchlight and anti-aircraft units, we were trained in the full operation of all the equipment, apart from the duties of an officer, irrespective of what you were doing. That was the maintenance of the diesel of the searchlight and all the different forms and details you had to fill, being an officer responsible for men under you. But basically, no, it was just basically an extension of the stuff you'd been doing on site, but you had to be in charge, so you had to know everybody's job and maintenance work and everything else.
Where were the instructors coming from? Were they other ranks or officers
themselves? No, the instructors, this was a college, a peacetime one.
Now, were these peacetime tutors that we were taking?
I would assume, yes, they were regular people, because it still exists as Shrivenham, as a military training centre. And yes, they were very stern and strict in there, and you had to be...
Was there any change of uniform?
Not at that stage, no.
Can you describe the accommodation of the...
Well, it was actually just like a university. I mean, there were huge barrack blocks, and it was very well equipped indeed. I mean, there was all the facilities you needed. It was not in any way ramshackle. It was a beautiful building, parade grounds and barrack blocks and workshops. No, it was a fully integrated unit.
And did you sleep in dormitories?
Yes.
How many men would be to a dormitory?
I would rather to tell at this stage. A bit of a grey area so far back.
Did you have duties such as, I suppose, basic duties such as keep the place clean and...
Yes, we still have to maintain your...
Inspections?
Yes.
How often did they occur?
Well, there was a daily inspection of your stood by your beds, and everything was laid out in apple pie order. And sergeant majors would come around and check you all out and check you before you went on the parade or went to classes for instruction.
What time did your day start?
Well, if I can recollect, I think it was somewhere about 6 or 6.30.
And that would be reveille, presumably?
Yes, yes.
And then what did you do?
Well, you did all your ablutions and went, had your breakfast, and it would be about 8 o'clock by the time you went on parade for the first time.
And you were lectured to?
Yes, lectures and drill, using the equipment, you know, the diesel units, the searchlight, maintenance and repairs, and also lectures on officers' duties with regard to payrolls and all the other things which might involve an officer's duty in charge of a unit.
Was the equipment changing at this stage? Were you
getting
anything new? No,
nothing new at that stage, no.
Officers' duties, do you recall what the basic elements of that?
Well, basically, it was just all the paperwork, you know, the forms you had to fill in and whatever, but...
Was there any man management training, for example?
Well, it was difficult to describe it as such, because this was the regular army. So it was one of maintaining discipline, really, and how to treat, you know, circumstances as they arose within a unit of that nature.
Were there any that was?
Well, it was rather difficult to ascertain that, because I shouldn't think there would be many, certainly in the group that I was in. As far as I can recollect, I can't recollect anybody who was not commissioned as a result of being on that course. Of course, we wouldn't know that, because all you get is your own personal sort of acceptance as an officer and posting. And
there was no kind of a final parade with a parchment given out or some of that nature?
No. That might occur in peacetime, but in wartime it You know, they just be read out. This is it. You are now an officer in the Majesty's Army.
How long did the course last, Mr. Wood?
Well, as far as I can recollect, and I may have mentioned this earlier, it seems that's a bit of a grey area timing, but it was certainly no less than 3 months.
Then what happened at the end of the course?
Well, obviously you were then all paraded and you were told whether or not you had been accepted as an officer in the Majesty's Army. I can't recollect many failures, certainly amongst the group that I was with. And there were military tailors on hand, so then you got measured for whatever uniforms you required. There was allowance made so you could get, you know, a full kit outfitting at these people. And when you left there, you actually had your full army officers, Sam Brown, you know, uniform, cap, and all the paraphernalia that an officer had to wear.
Was this expensive?
There again, I wouldn't know really relative what how expensive it was. But there seemed to be a standard charge for everything, and these people were all ready on hand there, obviously recommended by the war establishment to supply uniforms and shoes and shirts, ties, caps to the new officers coming out of the course.
What do you get as an officer passing out? Is it a parchment or a piece of paper, anything of that kind, certificate of some kind?
No, I can't recollect ever being given anything of that nature.
So what rank did you pass out as?
Second lieutenant. Everybody passed out as second lieutenant.
Did you find it strange in the opening days?
No, because there was so many of us there. It was only when you left that environment that you suddenly realised that somebody coming down the street was going to salute you as opposed to you saluting them. But as one got some leave at home first, before your posting, it was a gradual sort of evolution from being a lance corporal to that. But once you put the uniform on, you'd been taught to expect this and how to return salutes and the rest of it, and it moved fairly easily along in the end.
So you went on leave when you came out?
Yes,
of the corporal.
And then you got a posting, which was sent to your home.
How did your parents receive you? You left as a private soldier, now you're an officer.
Well, my mother was very pleased. My dad died, as I told you, when I was a young man. And I had other two brothers at home. Harold, he became a sergeant PTI instructor in the Air Force. And my other brother then, who was the elder one, hadn't been even called up. So, no, they were very proud and very pleased for me.
How long was your leave?
Just a matter of probably 3 or 4 weeks. Till you virtually were told to... Once you'd got your equipment, go home and your posting would arrive. It was just a question of when the postings were sorted out and where you were required to report to.
So this time must have been around about the middle of 40?
Yes. It was... No, it would be the end, 14 months after the outbreak. It would be the end of 1940, really. Or early 41, possibly.
And where was your first posting?
My first posting was to Hastings. I was rather surprised. We were commissioned, at least most of them, I reckon, in the Royal Artillery. And my posting was to the 20th Royal West Kents, who were a battalion very similar to the territorial unit that I had in the Darlington area. But their area, where they'd moved to, where we'd moved to Bridlington, they'd moved to Hastings and inland up to East Grinstead and sort of Tunbridge Wells. They occupied that area, operating searchlight units, and that's where I was posted to. So I reported to Hastings to my new unit. As I say, it was the 20th Royal West Kents, and it's rather interesting because the bulk of the people in that had worked with the South East London Gas Board.
Did you put on their cap badge?
Yes, once you got, obviously you had your own, but we wore that for the time being, but I still didn't alter everything else, because I just obviously bought all that equipment, and it didn't really matter at that stage because you were on site anyhow. You didn't wear your normal stuff once on site.
How did the unit receive you?
Oh, very good, because they got several people, new intake, obviously. So now we were quite well received, and I had a very happy association with the people of the 23rd Royal Westkent.
You would be in the officer's mess.
No, at that stage we're actually out on site. You had an area to control, and within your site there was the troop headquarters, and you were in charge of a cluster of searchlights within your group, about six, and you were in charge of that, those particular sites, the men, the equipment and everything else. So no, I wasn't at headquarters at Hastings. Initially I was in Ticehurst, and around all areas inland from there. We kept moving around, obviously. But no, you were in charge of a sector within that battalion, and controlling about from a little troop headquarters, where you had your own troop headquarters staff, where you were responsible for paying the money out and provisions, and checking the equipment for the sites in your particular area.
So you're moving around quite a bit.
Oh yes, because I had the troop headquarters, and you visited all your sites during the daytime to check the equipment and pay out, obviously, the payday at all the different sites, and check the food was going in.
Had there been any improvement with the equipment at this
stage? At that stage, no, it was pretty much. But within a short space of time, they started talking about radar. This was to replace the antiquated listening devices with headphones, which were then disposed with. And the radar units were strapped or fixed on the side of the searchlights. And you sat on a bucket seat and you looked into this dial. And obviously, initially, you pointed or directed the searchlight to the source of sound and then switched on. And if you got a blip, then you just moved it around until you could locate it. And then once you'd got it on a central sort of line running across the radar, you threw the switch and put your searchlight on.
And that would actually...
Well, yes, within
reason.
Yeah, well, it was a vast improvement. You got a lot nearer than you were doing by the old hearing device.
And had you been trained in functioning with that?
Yes, we went on course. You know, each battalion had people coming down and explained the operation of the radar units and what to look for and the blips on the dials and everything else.
Were you linked into defence systems at this
not
time?
Not at that stage, no.
So what weapons did you have for anti-aircraft?
Firstly, just the same on the searchlight side, just a Lewis machine guns. You see, the anti-aircraft guns were separate from searchlights. They only operated in the London area, or areas of... We actually were in the countryside. So the actual anti-aircraft, as such, were in the coastal towns and on all approaches to London, where they were linked in with the searchlights, but where we didn't have any aircraft, anti-aircraft units to feed the information to.
So if you spotted an aeroplane, it either flew away or you got it...
Well, there were operating in that area. There was a night fighter base, and they used to go up on patrol when a raid was imminent. But ultimately... a system is organised where they put a box grid over all the southern counties of Kent and Sussex and inland towards London. And that box grid, what they decided to do, they reorganised the searchlight. In the centre of each box of the grid, you put a searchlight. And that searchlight did nothing but put a vertical beam up. So it was pointing up in the sky in the middle of this box. And with the big radar being installed at Beachy Head, which used to pick up the activities with the withdrawal from Dunkirk and everybody come back, the Germans had got a massive airfield at Abbeville, and we were in the direct flight path virtually between Abbeville and London for the bomber raids. So what used to happen then, we the radar used to pick them up, and they'd say, right, 40 plus activity, and they would feed that back from Beachy Head at the radar station to the night fighter squadron, and they would put up chaps on patrol. Ultimately, as I said, they put this box system in operation where there was a vertical beam, and they would orbit round this vertical searchlight beam up in the sky. And then as the enemy planes were coming, and if they entered that box, they would get instruction from the ground, and he would come out from orbit and come round in what they used to call the curve of the dog and track the aircraft passing through this box system. He also had some sort of radar on that he could actually then guide himself in to behind it and obviously then make visual contact and hopefully shoot him down.